Hello, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for joining IMPACTS's Invest in Women Symposium. I am your host, Kelly Baldoni. We are about to begin our final session of the day, How to Accelerate Growth in Your Practice in 2022. For everyone or anybody who has just joined today's events, I can recap logistical items before we move into the panel session. You'll be in listen-only mode and are encouraged to ask questions in the Q&A box. We will have time for that at the end of the session. If you have a specific question for someone on the panel, please note that in your question. If you have any technical issues, please drop us a chat in the chat box or in the Q&A, and somebody from IMPACTS will assist you right away. So with that, it's my pleasure to introduce my colleague, Jennifer Cannon, Vice President of National Accounts, who will be moderating our next session.
Thanks so much, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be here. I've really been looking forward to this session and hearing from the panelists. I know this is a time of year when we're all reflecting on the past 12 months, what's worked, what hasn't worked, but also thinking about what should I consider for 2022 and beyond for growth of my practice, not only from an investment management standpoint, but also thinking about the key trends. What are clients looking for? How do you engage with the next gen? And, you know, incorporating sustainable investing into that planning. So I have a powerhouse panel today. You have access to all of their bios, but I have Lily Traeger, Head of Investing for Impact at Morgan Stanley. I have Beth Chingodi, a diverse client segment leader at Wells Fargo, and Lynette Jefferson, Managing Director, Head of Sustainable Investing and Inclusive Investing Solutions. So I guess I'll get started, Lily, and ask the first question to you. I know you spoke at the event last year, and one of the things we talked about was what a pivotal year it was for sustainable investing. And I think it's fair to say this year's no different. The demand might even be stronger. So did you expect these kind of flows?
Great. Thanks so much, Jennifer, Kelly, and the entire IMPACTS team. It's a true pleasure to be here, one of my favorite events of the year. And I know virtually some of my fellow Morgan Stanley colleague financial advisors are out there listening, and hello to you all, as well as others joining from across the industry. As you said, Jennifer, right, following the watershed year that was 2020, a time where we collectively confronted three overlapping systemic crises, right, a health crisis, social justice crises, and climate crises. I think we all knew that 2021 would be big for sustainable and impact investing, right? Our clients and industry really felt just how important it was to put all tools and pools of capital to work, not just governments, right? Not just philanthropy, not just corporations, but also private investors, individuals, families, and institutions to truly generate solutions to these incredibly vexing problems. And what we really saw in 2020, at a time when, you know, there was market volatility, but overall solid performance across sustainable and impact investments, that investors signed up, right? They said, yes, I want to do this. But that in 2021, really the hard work began of implementing a strategy, right? And evolving a portfolio that is, for some, you know, working on behalf with their financial advisors, they were just cracking the book on developing a strategy and getting started allocating. For others, it was about applying additional lens, for example, advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion, or deepening a commitment to impact and sustainability, one that may have already been started. So 2021 was really the year, we believe, that people started to take action and take significant action and deepen their commitment by virtue of their investment policy statement and the ultimate implementation of applying this lens across all of their assets. So weren't terribly surprised by the numbers. Frankly, I think, you know, we want to continue to see acceleration of growth in this category because that'll lead to the end, which all of our clients are aspiring, a world where positive environmental and social outcomes are on par with financial returns and ultimately, you know, are visible, accessible, and measurable to the investor as well. So
thank you, Lily. I think we're all on the same page with that. We'd love to see when we get to a place where we're all making an impact on all of these challenges. And we're going to get into that in a little bit more detail. But Lynette and Beth, and maybe we'll start with Lynette, it would be great to hear your perspectives on this. Do you think we're in that sort of ESG bubble, or is this truly an investor trend?
Well, thank you first and foremost for the opportunity to be here with you all today, and good afternoon and good day to everyone. Again, no stranger to impacts, and you know, with this being my first entree into this forum, really grateful to be here also with my esteemed panelists. So many thanks to you all again. But listen, as far as the bubble, the answer is unequivocally no. Sustainability and impact are definitely here to stay. And that's because we certainly, all the persons on this panel, but we at UBS believe sustainability matters for all investors, as we like to say. So whether investors are primarily focused on financial returns or seeking to drive sustainable outcomes across environmental, social, and governance considerations, we believe sustainable investing can highlight risks and present new investment opportunities. So, you know, when we even think about it, Lily, you just alluded to this a little bit, but the world has obviously changed post-pandemic. And what we're seeing are some really, really interesting trends, right? So the pandemic has certainly elevated the importance of how companies operate and therefore accelerated the increasing relevance of sustainability considerations for our clients. So governments, businesses, consumers, and investors are all saying the same thing. There's an increased emphasis on sustainability. So as the world, you know, slowly and steadily returns to normal, we're also expecting overall and hopefully a transformed future. But this crisis, for one, has put the spotlight on a number of things that relate to sustainability. So a great example, obviously, and Lily, you touched on the DE&I aspect, but you know, I'd like to point to sort of what the, you know, the environment has done in terms of putting a spotlight on equality, inequality, and how that sort of relates to the sustainable investing conversation, right? Or in particular, the S in that equation, right? So when we survey investors, we find a lot of interesting results. 90% by, you know, one study that I often cite, but 90% of investors are now saying now is the time for large companies to focus on doing right by their workers, customers, communities, and the environment. Another, you know, nearly 90%, you know, in this one particular study say that companies exist to create value for multiple interests in society, not just for profit. 60% say they will buy or boycott based on a brand's response to you know, inequality, right? So these are things that are just happening kind of where we live. So this translates to obvious client demand for change and supports, again, the trends for sustainable investing and the flows that we're seeing. And the investment vehicle options are expanding, right? So there's no longer sort of this exclusionary, let's screen out, you know, negative industries or negative behaviors or even impact, right? Where we see the private markets, you know, direct deals, private equity, you know, to affect change. But we're seeing more and more opportunities and product types in the liquid markets, right? You know, things that are closer to, you know, much of what our retail investor would be focused on, things like mutual funds, ETFs, you know, separately managed accounts. I also think digitization is going to aid in the democratization of investing and product types. And I also think regulation, which I think we're going to get into a little bit later, will help aid with the transparency, streamlining, standardization that our investors are seeking. So, you know, final related point, I believe we're going to see more advancement in the trend of customization and personalization of SI portfolios based on client preferences. Investors may care about climate change, clean water, all of the environmental stuff, but we also know, you know, folks care, individuals care about things like smart mobility, technology, right, employee wellness, so on and so forth, gender equality. And with SI, they can better tailor against their preferences and lifestyles.
Thank you, Lynette. Beth, do you want to add on to that? Do you have any additional thoughts?
So one thing I did want to make sure to mention as we were talking about this notion of bubble versus whether this is truly the shift is there's also a massive generational shift that's starting to take place. And I know we're going to speak about that quite a bit more in our conversation today. But we know, for example, that $29 trillion is changing hands into the hands of women in intergenerational wealth transfer, not even in taking into account the wealth that they themselves create. But knowing how that intergenerational wealth transfer is coming and understanding the next generation and how value-focused and value-centric they are, you can see it in, you know, Lynette, I was smiling as you were talking about the democratizations. I love to talk to folks about, you know, you think about platforms like Kickstarter or you think about the GoFundMes. I mean, there is even down, and none of us want to cross into political, right? But even as you start to look at the quantity and size of political donations, what we are seeing is a massive shift towards the $5 here, the $10 here, I can support this in a micro way. And so the generation that is coming up is used to being able to put their money towards good and in these sort of micro donation elements. And so there is that very clear democratization. And with that inherently comes the democratization of so much of what we do, right? The information is no longer being held in this tower, in this ivory tower that previously only our fathers had access to. So I think that next generation, which is obviously a huge area of focus and huge area of passion for me, but that next generation is what is going to keep this conversation moving forward, because they've already made very clear. I mean, think about all the studies about millennials who would take a pay cut to work for a company whose values aligned with theirs. I mean, that's real, that's true. And we're seeing it now with the great resignation, right? We are seeing people living in their values. And that's something that is a little bit newer for this up and coming generation as that wealth is starting to transfer.
And I think that builds on what Lynette was saying too, you know, in terms of just what different generations are looking for and how it's changing. And it is exciting to see as wealth is transferred. But a question for all of you, when you look at your firms, are you also seeing assets come from more traditional sort of, you know, investors that are looking at the returns of sustainable investing and saying, I'm going to take another look? Or, you know, from advisors that are suddenly reflecting on that myth of underperformance, that really, that's not anything anymore, right? Evidence shows that that is not what's happening in terms of when we look at performance over the last few years and even longer across most asset classes. Maybe I'll start with you, Lily, in terms of flows. I mean, is there a shift from that mainstream investor too that's looking more closely and leading to the increase in flows?
Yeah, I mean, we can put a very fine point on it, right? So 80% of the asset managers that we partner with, right? We take a lot of pride in our open architecture platform that seeks to really onboard the best and the brightest investment strategies and have, right, very stringent, as you know, impacts due diligence processes that can assess sustainability impact holistically and from the stance of credibility, right? 80% of asset managers, irrespective of sustainable or impact, claim to have a documented approach to integrating environmental, social, and governance factors, climate, and or DE&I. 80%, right? Like, do we need to say any more about this being a mainstream investor concept? Right now, that doesn't speak to the credibility or authenticity of that approach and whether or not that's actually impacting the underlying investments, right, ultimately that are in the strategies. But this is absolutely a set of variables, right? Insights driving investor decisions at every level of the economy, mainstream, niche, et cetera. Now, the question around, you know, what sort of qualifies you for the higher bar of meeting our Investing with Impact platform, which, by the way, is less than 10% of those asset managers, is a really important one, especially in a context where mainstream investors are coming in and trying to define this around financial performance. Because we really believe that the true reason investors are here is ultimately to create a better world. And that doesn't mean you can't have financial viability or sustainability with a capital S. In fact, those are part and parcel in terms of creating the intended impact. If a company ceases to exist, right, ultimately you're not generating the intended impact. And in fact, a growing potential company that is authentically approaching impact and generating outcomes as they grow, which can be a challenge, is a way to scale and maximize impact. So absolutely sustainable funding models matter, absolutely credibility and authenticity of the approach to impact matters. And absolutely we're seeing a broad range of investors, including those motivated by financial returns, come to the table. That's kind of the broader context, right? But when you start to look at the two thematic pillars that are most relevant for our investors, decarbonization and transition to a low carbon economy and advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? We also know that some of the underlying metrics that are important to those are driving performance, right? And look no further, obviously, than the idea of having a diverse set of perspectives inside of an organization guiding strategy. And those companies do tend to be, by all measures of performance, stability, et cetera, ultimately better performing, right? And my team that leads our portfolio solution suite at Morgan Stanley took that data point and ultimately constructed a diversity, equity, and inclusion portfolio to frankly capture that financial opportunity and you know, provide it with a mainstream viability from a financial context, but equally to create non-financial returns and measure them in the same disciplined, rigorous way that we think about financial returns. So I think that's kind of the area we are right now, right?
It is.
Forget about the environmental and social returns, even when financial performance is, you know, helping to bolster broader mainstream interest.
It is. And it starts from the institutional space, and I think it moves down to the individual investor. Lynette, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I absolutely do. You know, it's interesting. I'll say this to the audience that I have been working now in the ESG space for just under 2 years. I have a background in just general advisory, particularly in the ultra high net worth space. So I am relatively new to the space, but why I wanted to bring that up was that the evolution that I've seen in terms of what matters, what's important, what clients are demanding, and how the trends are rapidly evolving in the course of 18, 20 months is nothing short of remarkable. And I don't think in my almost 30-year career that I've ever seen just so much change right daily. So on the one hand, if you just kind of look at it from the industry professional perspective and those of us that are, subject matter participants in the space, right? The way that we have been looking at sustainable investing, ESG, right, it is quickly evolving, right? So this notion of just integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into the investment decision or this process of integration, like that's becoming table stakes for asset managers. And the consideration of ESG risks, relative to opportunities, again, that is becoming the expectation of the market. So a lot of these methodologies that had been used heretofore are now becoming business as usual. So that's like kind of, the one bit of it when we look at the, investment community. But on the investor side, there's also a really interesting trend as well. We think that sustainable investing is attracting more investors deliberately, but not deliberately. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. The conversations around sustainable are becoming more mainstream. Turn on the news, look at advertising, right? For the products and services that we consume, right? Retail and otherwise. ESG, sustainability is all being weaved into just the day-to-day mainstream, right? And so, yes. Investors are still motivated, to drive social and environmental outcomes. But I also think that we're seeing this confluence of things happening just in our daily lives, right? That are kind of changing the way investors are thinking about and also giving our advisors the ability to start these conversations that are relevant for where, for where clients and investors live, their lifestyles, their places of business, their communities. And,
definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So it's really, really interesting to see the trend.
And to have more people understand the benefit of investing this way.
Yeah.
And I think there was a recent survey done and all three of you have kind of quoted it, and the top of mind issues right now are climate change and inequality. I mean, you can't hide from those issues. You look out your window, climate change. You read the paper, inequality. Just to finish off on this topic, Beth, I know Wells Fargo has experienced significant growth in sustainable investments. Are you seeing it again? Is it, you're seeing the mainstream assets, sort of the advisors that maybe weren't using it before suddenly starting to use more of it?
So I think the points that both Lily and Lynette have made are spot on, right? It has, sustainability has inevitably become part of the broader conversation. And to Lynette's point, right, even it's just a part of our lives, right? We watch an advertisement and they're talking about, you know, we're your energy company, but don't worry, we're also focused on what's happening here across right. the globe. And so it's supposed to make you feel better, right, about Con Ed. That being said, there's also an element of it that even the advisors who were sort of the holdouts, right, or to your point, are still pointing to sort of the antiquated data of, oh, well, the returns aren't right. there. As the next generation of client is asking about it, it's no longer an opportunity of, will I get into this space? Will I not get into this space? If you're not providing the answer, somebody else is going to.
Right.
And so while you never want to use that scare tactic with your advisor, you know, it's a matter, as I coach advisors on working with women all across the country. And as I'm speaking to them and I'm talking to them about that which female clients value, and that word, right, that how heavily values driven our female investors are. As you're starting to talk about, I mean, we have all of these strategies around deepening the relationship across the family and intergenerational relationships. And if you're not willing, if you're not already wired to be, to answer questions and to be thoughtful and to illustrate, not just like, oh, that's a thing we have on the shelf, but I live and breathe it. And here's right. what I do. And here's how I'm philanthropic. If you're not ready to come to the table with that, you are already going to be at a palpable disadvantage when you're talking to the next generation, particularly if that next generation is female-led.
Definitely, you're going to miss the opportunity. And so with that in mind, so we think about one of the challenges I've heard from the field when I talk to advisors is, great, I understand how much growth is there. I know I need to integrate it into my practice, but how do I bring it up with clients? How do I build portfolios? And so Lily and Lynette, what are some of the tools that you have to support advisors? And really, what is being requested the most? Because I have some ideas, but I'd love to hear from you.
So I have a mentor in financial services who many years ago told me there are three ways an advisor can start a conversation with a client without looking stupid, which is obviously important, right? Especially on a topic like sustainable and impact investing, where you may be feeling, not anybody on this call, right, but others that you may, you know, partner with or come into contact with, maybe feeling a bit behind on this overall discussion, right? The puck's moved fast and right. maybe this isn't a conversation you've embedded in any of your ongoing client, you know, management and engagement. So how do you approach that, right? And the way to approach it is either something about you as the advisor has changed. I read this book, it changed my life, right? Or something about the firm has changed. We just launched this new, you know, impact reporting capability, Morgan Stanley IQ, and it gives me access to data-driven insights I didn't have before, right? Or something about the client has changed. Hey, I know I've been managing your assets for a long time, but I did notice in our last discussion, you mentioned joining a nonprofit board focused on K-12 education in your local community. Is that something you're interested in exploring in your investments? So something about you as an advisor can change, something about the firm can change, or something about the client. And those are all catalysts to integrate this. But importantly, money in motion is also a catalyst. Right? When you're hiring or firing a manager or making a decision about allocating capital, new money in, for example, obviously we're all focused on growth metrics and this is a business growth panel, right? That's a real opportunity to take a step back and discuss building an impact strategy. And the way you do that is with the same discipline and rigor that you approach creating your financial goals, right? Establishing upfront impact goals, developing a plan, and ultimately implementing that plan over time by selecting investment vehicles that can deliver both the client's financial and impact goals is essential. And you have all the tools at your disposal, as Lynette said at the beginning, right? In terms of the diversity of, you know, investment strategies and asset class and geographic context and minimums and styles and themes. Really, you have, you know, right now sort of an embarrassment of riches. So don't feel like you're going into these conversations unequipped to be able to deliver because, you know, actually you are in a situation where the market has evolved and you can trust that if your client's interested, you can tap into the resources at your firm and you can help them to build an effective strategy.
That's really helpful, Lily. And I know you have a ton of resources that your team depends on when they come to you, everything from, again, like, what's a line of questioning? How do I figure out the issues they really care about, to portfolio construction? And Lynette, we've talked a lot about UBS and your focus on this area. What are some of the resources and tools that your team is asking for?
Yeah, no, well, thank you. And, we took it, as probably many of you know on this call, to a different level in that, about a year ago or so, we declared that sustainable investments are now our preferred solution for all of our clients, right? Big, bold statement, essentially the first to do it amongst our peers. And it really was driven by everything that we're talking about here today, that we have such a fundamental belief in how mainstream this style of investing is going to become, that we are evolving, our activities, right? Not only as a wealth management or financial services firm, but just us as a firm and as a global citizen towards sustainability. We've redefined our purpose statement, right, at the global level. We are now reimagining the power of investing, connecting people for a better world. And I think what's obvious there, that says a lot, short statement, it says a lot, but there are obviously sustainability implications there also. But, you know, what that means and what it translates into, for the US and in particular for the wealth management division. And I love, Lily, how you were kind of speaking about, the time is now to act. There are so many tools and resources just available across all of our firms, and many advisors, I think, can even get overwhelmed, right, with where to start because there's so much out there. But I think, here we are taking, thought leadership, we're translating things that are coming out of our investment office into sort of in the box implementation ideas for those people that want those, and it's just sort of off the shelf implementation, to more complex things like taking, and again, Lily, you were kind of referring to this, where if there's money in motion, if there's a, liquidity event, if there's an interest in transitioning a portfolio, we have, with our portfolio construction experts at UBS, developed a roadmap and a guide based on our sustainable investing dedicated strategic asset allocation to give them that roadmap to perhaps transition
right.
the portfolio with minimal tax implications. Again, we are, there's nothing that can replace sort of hand-to-hand, or in-person market activity. So whether it's working with our third-party asset managers, our asset managers, to do training, education, awareness, I mean, countless tools, resources, guides, teach-ins, trainings, mobilizing the sales force, you name it. So it's really just about finding what's right for you in a client situation. Maybe it's planning, maybe it's a generational transfer. A big part of my job is just building the set of solutions so that advisors can say, here's my situation,
right.
here's the
right.
client, I'm going to take this off the shelf and make it easy to have the conversation.
So Beth, from a broader standpoint, so when we're thinking about business growth, practice management, especially as you're coaching the teams, how to tap into the newer segments in the market, what are some of the practice management tools and resources that you're getting requests for?
Absolutely. So I've been kind of smiling as you guys have been speaking, because one of the things that's really remarkable about this group is that we sort of had the opportunity to touch the advisors at every part of the continuum, right? So you're focused, Lynette, you were speaking about how you're really preparing the solutions and sort of preparing that menu, whereas I spend a lot of my time, Lily, I was smiling with your three things because I think that's wonderful. I spend a lot of my time kind of coaching advisors as to how to have those conversations. The pending change that is happening all around us is scary for advisors. Let's just be candid, right?
Yep.
We know industry-wide, so not just my firm or your firms, but all the firms, right? We know that the average financial advisor is a 58-year-old straight presenting cisgendered white male. And we know that the world around us, the next generation, is not the same, right? We know that 20% of millennials identify as LGBTQ+. We know that by 2045, there will be no ethnic majority. We know, I already spoke about the $29 trillion into the hands of women. We know how the world is shifting. And so a lot of the work that I do is helping to empower. I was joking to someone the other day that I'm an ally coach, right? Because if we had 52% of our financial advisors were women, then it would be easy because I could sort of, allocate it that way. we know that from an industry perspective, again, our industry advisors are about 85% male to 15% female. And so I spend a lot of time teaching folks how to sort of speak other. And so, you know, Lily, to your point about what has changed from the client perspective, that's what we know that our female clients want. We know that female investors don't feel seen and they don't feel heard. We actually conducted a fairly significant client research study at the end of 2020. We launched it publicly in 2021. And one of the biggest takeaways, right? So our ultra high net worth clients, the women who, and these were both clients and internal, the women who already, you know, they were in their upper 60s, already had a financial advisor, felt confident about where things were. The next generation, millennial women who we have a history of sort of freezing in time. And I think a lot of people think about millennials and they think they're 25 and they're living
exactly.
Fact is that geriatric millennials, as some of us are called, which I refuse to receive that name because I feel like that's ridiculous. But we're in our 40s, we're paying taxes, we're having children, we're taking care of our parents while we're taking care of our own children. And in that subset, there is a 30-point difference between what millennial women want to talk about and what financial advisors are speaking to them about today. 30-point difference. And so we can't be terribly surprised that 90% of millennials plan on leaving their parents' advisors.
Right.
That's another fact that likes to scare folks. And so a lot of what I do from a practice management perspective is talking about future-proofing your business. We talk to advisors all the time about future-proofing your business in the context of learning new technology or getting folks on LinkedIn or things of that nature. Also, a huge element of future-proofing your book is starting to have meaningful conversations with the next generation. It is not just, long are the days where you can sit down with an advisor and say, well, make sure that you're looking at the wife in the meeting. I still periodically will come across materials like that. And I'm like, we need to be throwing those materials out. None of this, like,
definitely.
Make sure you're looking to the wife every three times. I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Very old school. Yes.
Very old school. Discovery, and it's not that we're reinventing the wheel, right? I forgive me. One of you guys mentioned it. You mentioned it perfectly. What we're asking advisors to do and what advisors really need to do to capture this audience and to engage this audience and to build those long-term relationships isn't dramatically different, right? It's still discovery. It's the same discovery it always was, but it's active listening. And it's a recognition of the fact that, for example, female clients, and this is my favorite stat, every advisor I ever speak to, this is one of the first things that I share with them. Female clients are 12 times more likely to give a referral on a good product or service, 12 times more likely. So I talked to advisors and I'm like, you know, I spoke with someone and he said, my best client is a woman and I want to figure out how to replicate her. And I was like, then listen to her, pay attention to her. Most likely she's got friends who align with her. We are social beings. And so we build circles. This is part of candidly what gets us in trouble from a broader, right? As we were talking about injustice and inequity, it's what gets us in trouble because we build an echo chamber of people who are just like us. But be thoughtful about that. You know, when you get a referral, say thank you. When they lose a family member, send a condolence. Women appreciate that high touch more than ever before. And while, yes, that might require more time on from an intake perspective, what you'll find from a client tendency perspective is that we know that female clients, while they want to be educated on the front end, tell me what you're going to do, and then I don't actually want to be in your business. Female clients are typically born delegators. And so they trust their advisor. All you have to do is give them the time and the energy on the front end to make sure that they know that you're hearing them. Be an active listener. Don't kick off client meeting, you know, your quarterly meetings with, let's talk about your returns. That's
right.
Not what they want to talk about.
Right.
I've already laid out for you the four things I care about. Talk to me about those. To Lily's point, I've told you that I just joined a nonprofit board. Ask me about that. Ask me if that's something that matters to me. As we're talking about, you know, wealth transfer, and we're talking about the legacy I'm leaving, remember that I joined that board and ask me if I want to be thoughtful about, you know, carving out funds. So sometimes it's just a matter of listening a little bit harder, which I know is sometimes a difficult muscle for some to flex, but that's also where the diversity of your team comes into play, where you can start to build a team and bring people around you with different skill sets. And so if that's not one of yours, maybe that's an opportunity from a teaming perspective to bring on someone whose EQ skews a little bit more
a little bit differently.
Absolutely.
That report was really impressive. I mean, all three of you have come out with some very interesting studies about investor behavior and what they're looking for. So I always enjoy reading them, and I'm always surprised with some of the stats. They give me hope. So now I'm going to put you on the spot. So when we think about the tools and the resources, we think about the growth in this space before we sort of transition to the next subject. I would love to hear success stories. So advisors that have come to you, have tapped into your resources, your expertise, and have been able to close significant new business, connect with a family member they haven't before, or even have done creative things this year to connect with their clients during, you know, how limited we've been in terms of engagement. So if, you know, Lynette, I would just ask you if you could share an example of an advisor who's just has a great, you know, a great story to share over the past year.
Sure, happy to. And the good news is that I have dozens.
Of course.
And hopefully there'll be more, but I don't know if I could have said that 2 years ago, right? So I think one of the a big one that comes to mind, and you know, just a several hundred million dollar win with a multi-gen family office. It took place actually with a new team to UBS. So a team that was, you know, newly recruited into UBS. You know, into our private wealth organization, you know, had a large client that, and this to me sometimes is rare, right? But a large client that was 100% fully sold on sustainability, the ESG story, very well versed, right? As right. was, you know, the, you know, the G1, you know, the generation and the G3, the children. So it wasn't necessarily a story of right, trying to get this client over, you know, to our firm and sell them sustainability. It was like, what more can you show me, right, that we don't already know? And so what we were really proud of is being able to deliver the firm across, you know, a lot of different experts, whether it's, you know, the product teams, solutions teams, our industry leading CIO, our portfolio advisory group, and everybody that we needed around the table to in this case, prove to, you know, this multi-hundred million dollar client that we not only talk the talk and, you know, we walk the walk and we weren't sustainable in name only. And that wasn't easy, right? So again, it was rounds of conversation, rounds of proof points, right? And Beth, I love, you know, just sort of the way you describe how the conversations really do need to be personal. They need to be, you know, logged into our brains when we're dealing with clients to tailor the conversations because, you know, clients are more astute, right? So they wanted to know tools, resources. If we come here, how are we going to be supported? You know, how is this going to be reported? How are you going to prove to me that, you know, my investments are doing, you know, what they say they are, and what kind of shelf do you have, and is it growing? So great story. Client is here, obviously. I'm actually becoming more friendly with the family. Advisors are happy. Everybody's happy. So, you know, we've had tons of those. And then one other thing I'll just mention very quickly, it's not necessarily a success story, but Beth, it kind of goes back to what you were saying. We recently did our annual sustainable investing forum. We had one segment where we had a, you know, an advisor team sharing success stories. But what this particular advisor team did, to your point, was they started appointing sort of, they have some millennials and Gen Xers on the team, CSAs, investment associates. And that group became the chief millennial. They named somebody the chief millennial officer, right? So that team of younger next gen professionals are developing a strategy for that particular team to be able to speak to clients where they are. So, you know, they market themselves as having a chief millennial officer that talks about all things sustainability. So I thought that was really cool. And I think it underscores exactly what you were saying. So kudos to that particular team at UBS.
That is a great example, and being able to engage with Gen 1 through Gen 3 and bring them all on, much less get them in a meeting together, is phenomenal. So thank you for sharing. And Beth, you're shaking your head. So is there one that comes to mind for you?
There is actually. And it's so interesting. You know, you were talking about the dynamic of getting everybody in a room. So we have a group at Wells Fargo called Family Dynamics. And this is a group that is wholly focused on working with these massive, you know, these families and sitting down and having conversations. And as we all know, right, families are incredibly complicated. So it was funny because actually one of the, just a kind of an aside, but I will say our family dynamics group, because, you know, we've all transferred into this weird, like we're in our living room. Some of us are in living rooms, some of us are in offices. And actually we heard some feedback from the family dynamics group specifically that particularly when you were trying to get a family together, that actually if, you know, brother and sister don't want to be in the same room, but they'll go in the same, they'll join in a Zoom together. And so it's been really interesting because some of these, because you think about the kinds of families that typically would use a family dynamics group and you have this vision and they're sort of these like older established, and, you know, the notion that you couldn't get folks in the same room, it's like watching Succession play out in real life, right?
Right, it is.
But yeah, so actually one of my favorite stories is actually tied to that group. So we had the opportunity to do a client. And so one of the things that I do, right? So I like to joke to everybody, I'm our chief professional feminist. And so we did, I have a map, a mug that says so and everything. So we did a client event. It was a regional client event in Southern California. And we had an author speak, we had a couple of folks, and we had one of our family dynamics consultants speak, and she came on, and it was for primarily for existing female clients, but obviously folks were invited, were allowed to invite a couple of prospects. And so this was an existing client. So she had an existing long-standing relationship with an advisor, and she attended the event. And during the event, as the family dynamics consultant was speaking and kind of explaining what her group does, this woman reached out to her advisor and said, just to clarify, do we have access to this group? And he wrote back and said, of course, I can set up a meeting. And so sure enough, a week later, they set up a meeting. It turned out that this family was getting ready to liquidate their business. They hadn't decided yet what they were going to do because they were very concerned about the financial impact with their children. Their children didn't get along well, and they weren't really sure the best way to handle it. They sat down, they had a series of meetings with our family dynamics consultants, whose first action is to root everyone in values. I keep coming back to values, but when it comes to female investors, we are a values-driven group. We are driven with our dollars. Right. I mean, to your point about 60%, right, that would boycott or purchase, that is driven dominantly by women. And so sure enough, because of that conversation and our kind of opening this client's eyes to the family dynamics group, and candidly, right, shame on the advisor for not having thought to bring that group in yet, but sometimes it's a new muscle for all of us. We had the opportunity. So they did ultimately move forward with that liquidation. We retained the assets. And as a result of that, that advisor then brought in an additional $700 million.
Wow. That's a great one. Congratulations.
$700 million from one client event and an abundance of meetings. And as a result, right, it's not just that the mom and dad appreciate that you're bringing their kids to the table. The kids also get an opportunity to feel heard, to feel like I'm not being treated like mom and dad giving me an allowance. Here's someone who's actually hearing about what I value. And so that also then builds that relationship for the advisor across those generations as well.
It definitely does. And I found it really interesting partnering with your advisors to do presentations for their clients, you know, beginning of the pandemic and now still. And the goal was always to bring that next gen into the conversation, have them attend these presentations. It never really happened, but suddenly you'd have so-and-so's child on the call. And it was like, this is great. It's working. So hopefully that continues to happen. Now, Lily, I've been lucky enough to be on a couple calls with you, and you've shared some great success stories from your teams that have, you know, used your tools like MSIQ that have really depended on your team to close new business. Do you mind sharing one or two?
Sure. Thanks, Jennifer. And those are great stories, Beth and Lynette. I think you know that we are, you know, still, I believe, the only firm, certainly the first firm that has a formal designation to identify top practitioners right. focused on sustainable and impact investing. So originally called Champions, now Directors, Investing with Impact Directors. And we've got a pretty rigorous set of prereqs in order to join that illustrious group, which today is under 100 advisors across the country, about 88 in total, about a third institutional, third ultra high net worth, and a third more core retail focused in all regions, right? So this really is a national phenomena. And, you know, we spend a lot of time with these directors, as you know, Jennifer, from having impacts participate in our annual directors gatherings, which have been going for the last 7 years. And, you know, we really indoctrinate this group with our best and brightest ideas and from internal experts as well as external experts. And so this group tends to get sort of, you know, their pick when clients come to the firm and are interested in pursuing sustainable and impact investing because they're very well positioned to deliver on the client's needs. But, you know, also these same teams are able to build their own network and relationships and find, you know, clients through organic avenues as well. So there's an example of a California-based investing with impact director team. They have two directors on the team. One was a recruit from JP Morgan who had led impact investing when she was there. And they essentially won a $1.1 billion Bay Area foundation who wanted to ensure that its investments were supporting the same, you know, environmental, racial, and gender equity goals that their philanthropic efforts were. And what this team found is that by utilizing Morgan Stanley IQ, they could actually demonstrate that the investments were aligned with its mission and impact goals. And, you know, there's a great quote from one of the directors who said something like, in the nonprofit world, right, impact reporting is as important as investment performance. And the client was very metrics driven. And, you know, Morgan Stanley IQ was the only way to show that. So that was definitely a fantastic example. And the team really leveraged all of the firm's capabilities to deliver there. But I also, you know, we talk about all segments, and obviously Morgan Stanley Wealth Management strategy has really expanded across segments with the acquisition of E-Trade and with our effort in the workplace category, which are, you know, equally as motivated around impact and sustainable investing. So I love a story that one of my colleagues told me of a virtual advisor, right, sitting in a call center talking to an employee of a recent firm that had signed up for our workplace services, talking about living in Arizona and dealing with forest fires. And they thought, you know, they had the fortitude of mind to say, hey, what about our 10K minimum impact portfolios that maximize for ESG? Obviously, you know, Impacts does have some strategies in that as well. And they loved the expression, right, of sustainability in the context of climate mitigation, adaptation, and overall ESG as a holistic concept, and invested. And you know, I think it was just a really great example that you can sort of be at the billion plus level and the $10,000 account level, but ultimately servicing our clients' needs takes the same effort. And
it definitely does. It definitely does. And I think what you're all sharing is, you know, as we look at 2022 and beyond, you know, you really have to think about the segments you want to go after. And sustainable investing has to be a conversation. Values-based discussions are critical. And that is going to lead to growth because you just gave, you know, four different examples of advisors that have had success doing that. But I'm going to ask Kelly to jump back on because I know we have some questions for everyone that we'd love to address before we close up.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer. And to everybody, what an interesting conversation that probably can go on even longer, but in the interest of time, we do have a couple of questions from our audience. And if you haven't asked a question that you're dying to ask, please just submit it in the Q&A box. The first is on, I think it's in reference to something that you said, Lily, on just using change, right, as a way to initiate conversation. What about using the pandemic? Are you seeing advisors do that? You know, the influence of the pandemic, the momentum for equality, you know, that's just taking place right now. Is that a successful kind of in for sustainable investing?
I mean, I think the way we approach that is look, companies who were able to take care of their employees, right, and who were able to innovate in terms of their practices and were governed with integrity, right, had leaders who could be kind of visionary during this really challenging time, were ultimately the companies that acted as a proxy for resilience during that volatile market environment, the March of 2020 coronavirus sell-off and ensuing volatility and expansion. So I think, you know, that's typically the angle that COVID, right, this idea that, you know, companies that are better performing in terms of taking care of their assets, their human capital, you know, ultimately leads to better innovation on the product and service side, which can ultimately lead to top line growth. I think that's really the angle that COVID has been most interesting. And then of course, on the risk mitigation side as well. But, you know, I would really take a lot of these so why is decarbonization and why is advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion the two most popular or consistent themes we hear from our clients and advisors, right? In my very humble opinion, it's because these are the most systemic issues of our time, as in they're literally related to every other possible issue out there. And so, you know, I think kind of getting at that intersectionality and some of the underlying themes or the motivations for why a client might be interested in these broad systemic topics, I think can help to build a more diverse range of investment strategies for you to pursue with your client, right? Really understanding, is it about the supply side, renewable and alternative energy, or is it about building the infrastructure and energy efficiency, you know, to support a more circular economy? Or is it about sustainable ag and water, right? And alternative plant protein and things of that nature. And so getting at the deeper motivations can really, within these broad systemic themes, can really help to drive better portfolio construction in terms of a broader tool set that you have to be able to construct a diverse and risk-aware portfolio. And look, during COVID or not, that's going to ultimately help you to meet your clients' financial and impact goals.
I think probably anybody could answer this next one. How do you gain the trust of clients who are skeptical on ESG or impact, but you as an advisor feel pretty strongly about it? What are some successful ways, I guess, to navigate that situation? And Jen, feel free to chime in because you're having a lot of these conversations too.
Well, I want to hear from Lynette and Beth and of course Lily, but I've been on those calls. So I've had advisors ask me to join with the most, you know, non-believers, as we call them, that, you know, just don't agree. And if I lead or the advisor leads with the value proposition, many times we'll lose that client or that prospect because we have to come at it in terms of, like Lily was saying, risk mitigation and performance. And then once you start to have that conversation and you share research and you show the impact it can have on a portfolio, that's when you circle back and say, I know you sit on the board for a land trust. I know you have property right on the shoreline. Did you know actually these issues? That's what climate change is impact. Of course it is. This is something that I care about. Wow, we can bring these two together. But I'll defer to Lynette and Beth.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't have like too much to add to that particular point, Jen, because that is exactly right. Like what I have been recommending is that, right, do not force feed the conversation, right? Obviously, right? But it has been more or less about finding points of entry that have to do with lifestyle, places of business, family events, right? If you're an advisor that really knows your client, or if you start to sort of get into, right, the true skill of knowing your client, I believe there's always an entry point, right, as it relates to just human beings, right, and global citizens in terms of day-to-day decision-making, day-to-day lifestyles, where you can, you know, find a way to have the discussion. And again, what we're seeing a lot too is when we compare, you know, very, you know, high demand, household names, right, sort of in the investment management space that are just traditional SMAs, mutual funds, ETFs, what have you, there tends to be a comparable product that is performing just as well, if not better, right, than, you know, what a typical client would be familiar with. And what we're encouraging, you know, advisors to do where appropriate, and when you have that entry point, is maybe have a conversation comparing, you know, the investments, because, you know, all things being equal, these are both performing well, but here's actually an investment that's a little more aligned with some of your interests, lifestyles, family, you know, work, et cetera. And, you know, we have more and more examples of that. So it's finding the entry point where appropriate, don't force feed, and bring in experts, you know, when you don't know, right?
Of course.
But also, you know, don't be afraid to actually introduce a comparison between an investment or name that a client may be familiar with you know, the analog that happens to be ESG.
I don't have much to add, mostly because I think, Lynette, you summarized it perfectly. It is about really knowing your client. There is absolutely that entry point. I mean, there's so much now that really falls into sustainability, that whether it is, you know, you just had a grandchild and we're thinking about the future, or, you know, your university, I know you went to X university and they just made a huge announcement about their endowment, or you're retiring from, right, so I'm in St. Louis, and so you're retiring from Monsanto. I know food insecurity has always been a pillar of their foundation, or I guess they're called Bayer now, but, you know, the food insecurity. And so it's really a matter of knowing your client, I am with you 100%, Jennifer. You got to lead with the data. You got to lead the data for, and the performance first and foremost with this current generation. And as you continue to have the ongoing conversations, I mean, I talk to advisors all the time. I used to teach social media. And so we talked about listening and figuring out what matters to them. If you know that your client's 30-year-old daughter is incredibly involved in environmental, then as you're starting to have the next generation conversations, you make sure that she knows that her parents have recently, you know, made a shift, and obviously within privacy regulations, but I agree 100%. You lead with the data first and foremost. There is always that entry point. And again, as you're having the next generation conversations, this will matter to them far more than what the cost basis was when your dad got Apple 24 years ago.
It's so true. So true.
I have a maybe conflicting response here.
That's okay.
That's all right.
Just for the fun of it. I would highly suggest you find an investment strategy that doesn't have any mention of sustainable impact or ESG, right, of which there are many, and include it in the portfolio by virtue of its investment merit. And, you know, and or look at their existing portfolio, and there's a high likelihood that they do have some investment strategies in their portfolio that are already considering ESG or even impact metrics, right? And actually, you know, don't try to convince them to do something. Maybe just show them that this is actually kind of the arc that the industry is going. And oh, by the way, use the oh, by the way, this also happens to take into consider ESG and impact. Like, you can only push so much, but it's like people need to experience something to kind of realize that, like, oh, it's actually not that big of a deal. So it's related to the find the analogous investment strategy, but maybe a little sneakier.
And I like it. I like it.
If I just, Lily, that is brilliant. And what is so funny is that that is actually happening without even being deliberate. Like, the flows that we're seeing into these products are not necessarily, you know, by virtue of these advisors, you know, being believers. These are just great performing products. And oh, by the way, they just happen to be sustainable investments in your client's portfolio. So brilliant point.
I mean, my favorite is the board of trustees, that you kind of go through the broad strategy conversation on whether or not they want to integrate this into their IPS. And then they get to know, right? Or let's kick the can down the road. And then you actually look at their portfolio and you're like, oh, they've got a diverse owned manager. Oh, this manager incorporates ESG on a systematic basis. Oh, this manager has impact reporting. And then you can basically say, well, guess what? This is happening whether or not you take a strategic position on it. So, hey, why not help to, you know, build a strategy around it?
So true.
Well, I think that might be a perfect place to end. So thank you guys. That was an incredible conversation. I think we all learned a lot. And thanks, Jen, for moderating. And again, to our audience, thank you for joining not just this session, but if you are on previous sessions throughout the day, we are so appreciative of your time and the enthusiasm that you brought with you. I mentioned earlier that all sessions were recorded and will be emailed to you once available. So we look forward to continuing the conversations of today and hope to speak with you all again soon. So have a great rest of your day. Thanks.
Thank you.